45 years ago today, the Soviet Union startled the world and panicked the United States by launching the first space satellite. One of the reporters who covered the story was Walter Cronkite. He recalls now how an artificial moon cast such a long shadow over the strongest country on Earth.
In that autumn of 1957, American dominance in global technology was taken for granted. We were so certain of our supremacy, schools were going progressive. Life skills were replacing the old academic grinds of physics and math. Some schools even questioned the need for grades at all. It all seemed so modern and enlightened, that quiet autumn 45 years ago. Then on October 4th came an announcement from Radio Moscow. And we suddenly discovered that we had been blindsided by our own enlightenment and beaten at our own game.
This is Radio Moscow, and here is the news.
As a result of intensive work by research institutes and designing bureaus, the first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
To say that that announcement caught us by surprise is an understatement. We were dumbfounded. Moscow had launched a surprise attack against something believed invulnerable, American confidence. What the White House and Pentagon surely knew but didn't first admit was that it was not the satellite that was the issue, but the rocket that put it into orbit. A dozen years before, such rockets might have meant a German victory in World War II. In the fall of 1944, as a correspondent with the 101st Airborne, I had watched the launch trails of the V-2s over Western Holland on their way to London. Fortunately, they came too late to help Hitler. In less than a year, Germany was in ruins, and many of the scientists who had built the rockets were on their way to the Army Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. For the next 10 years, they would do almost nothing. But American neglect seemed reasonable enough at the time. We had strategic bomber bases around three sides of the Soviet Union. They had none near the United States. America didn't believe it needed long-range rocket technology. The Soviets knew that they did. The news broke on Friday night, too late for the 15-minute CBS Evening News with Doug Edwards. So most Americans picked up what details they could from bulletins, local newscasts, and even network comedy programs that weekend. Within 24 hours, Sputnik was a part of American culture, as Ernie Kovacs helped viewers track its course.
The Polly Bergen Show!
Ernie, what's wrong?
Well, those Russians did it, didn't they? It goes 18,000 miles an hour, that little satellite. When Perry Como goes on the air, goes all the way through Polly Bergen Show, and just as Gisela saying hello, it's back in Moscow.
The next day, Sunday, CBS presented a special report on the launch.
CBS Television presents a special report on Sputnik 1, the Soviet space satellite. Douglas Edwards reporting.
Until 2 days ago, that sound had never been heard on this Earth. Suddenly, it has become as much a part of 20th century life as the whir of your vacuum cleaner. According to the latest Soviet announcement, the satellite is still maintaining its speed of 18,000 miles an hour, meeting no resistance 560 miles out in space. For the Soviet Union, it's an opportunity that may be without precedent in the field of propaganda. Moscow has not been passing up its opportunity.
Propaganda is a word we don't often hear these days. But in 1957, it was the live ammunition in the public relations war between communism and capitalism. That weekend, Soviet rhetoric was on a tear, portraying communism as a system that got results, while we stood by in surprise and confusion. Unfortunately, it was not wholly inaccurate. We had lost the space race before we knew we were in it. It hurt badly. Then, a month later, to the day after Sputnik, still more bad news.
Good evening. I'm Walter Cronkite, and this is Sunday News Special. For tonight, you'll see...
It was Sunday, November 3rd, 6 p.m., when I went on the air from Studio 42 in Grand Central Station.
Well, there's a new sound in outer space tonight, and here is its picture, an oscillograph of Sputnik number 2. The Russians launched their second Earth satellite shortly after midnight, our time this morning. It is six times bigger than Sputnik number one, and it's circling the Earth twice as far out in space. But most fascinating of the facts, Sputnik 2 has a passenger. It is this dog, a female husky named Curly, Kudryavka in Russian.
The tabloids called it Mutnik. But Democrats were less amused. They indignantly called for a shakeup in the American rocket program and even a congressional probe. But Democratic indignation was nothing as compared to that of
dog lovers around the world. From Singapore to Cincinnati, they've risen in a chorus of protests. Marches on Soviet embassies in various capitals are planned, and the National Canine Defense League of Britain has called dog lovers to a minute of silence each day in prayer for Curly's safe return to Earth.
In the anxiety of the moment, some American scientists predicted the Soviets would be on the moon within a week. It was a measure of how little even our experts really knew about space. This was confirmed in December when our first satellite reached an altitude of 4 feet. Before its rocket exploded. Headline writers promptly anointed it the Stayputnik and Kaputnik, Bob Trout reported.
The button pushed about 15 minutes before noon, following hours of preparation, the 72-foot rocket going up no higher than 4 feet in 2 seconds. Then, in the words of Paul Waltz, the deputy director of Project Vanguard, something happened, we don't know what.
What happened was simple. In those days before NASA unified the space program, the real space race was between our Army, Navy, and Air Force. Each had its own top-secret rocket program and a fervent, almost chauvinistic determination to be first. The result was division and inefficiency. The rivalry was so intense, Bob Hope joked that the Army was building a rocket that could completely wipe out the Air Force. But by the end of the year, there seemed little to laugh about. For a generation, the most powerful force in world affairs
has been the United States of America. Last October 4th, a new moon came over the horizon and cast a different light on our affairs. Sputnik was a serious threat, if not to our immediate security, then to our sense of security. It shook the confidence of our allies, the respect of the neutral.
Two weeks after the first Sputnik, I began hosting a new CBS Sunday series called The 20th Century. For me, both the program and its remarkable producer, Burton Benjamin, could not have come at a better time. In the fall of 1957, my presence on CBS was confined mostly to reruns of a waning series called You Are There and one newscast a week, the Sunday News Special. Because the 20th century could tackle a range of topics, Benjamin and I saw it as an opportunity to address what we both recognized as one of the defining stories of our time. As the new year began, American failure to match the Soviets was reaching panic proportions. A country accustomed to being first wanted to know where it stood.
This is our subject for the next 90 minutes. As CBS News reports to the nation, where we stand. A special edition of The 20th Century.
On the first Sunday of 1958, producers Les Midgley and Don Hewitt assembled a special 90-minute 20th Century that tried to offer some answers, and not necessarily ones the country hoped to hear. Satellites, I said, were not as benign as we thought. A satellite is the only really accurate source of information
you need to aim a ballistic missile. A satellite is also the basis of any possible defense against missiles. It can serve as a radar station in space, a warning system detecting a missile attack, and it can scout another country's territory as no ordinary reconnaissance plane can. This is the next step beyond the satellite, and not very far beyond. A huge satellite spinning slowly in its orbit. It can carry missiles of its own and drop them with sharp accuracy, fight unimaginable wars of its own in space. To sum up, in satellites, we are a year behind the Russians.
Supremacy had not only made us complacent, we concluded. We had passed it on to our children. If we were in a brain race with the Russians, then American schools would become a front line of national security. My colleagues Dan Shore and Alex Kendrick offered a gloomy comparison of the two systems.
The Russians began their satellite program right after the revolution, with an immense building project. What they built was schoolhouses. They announced they would master the world by mastering science. 30 years ago, we had 6 times as many scientists and engineers as the Soviet Union. Now they have as many as we do. And they're already forging ahead, because their colleges are turning out twice as many technical people this year as ours are. Education in Russia is a serious business.
At Alhambra High in California, the grind is not so tough. You can graduate without a single course in science. You might prefer a course in health and safety, personal grooming, or cooking for boys and girls.
In 1958, our educational system seemed to be sleeping, with its emphasis on social adjustment over basic knowledge. Among the most immediate consequences of Sputnik would be the great debate of American education and the roles of science and math.
5, 4, 3.
Finally, on January 31st, 3 months after Sputnik, America heard its first good news from Cape Canaveral. There were no press facilities at the Cape yet, and no advance word on launches. So reporters became accustomed to long nighttime stakeouts from distant vantage points. Charles von Frem described the launch of Explorer 1 by telephone.
And there is a sudden, tremendous burst of flame. It's red and orange and yellow. And slowly, ever so slowly, we can see the Jupiter C missile on its way. There is no deviation from course as it soars higher and higher into the heavens.
That Friday, millions of Americans went out into the cold and saluted the night sky. But the space race was far from over. America had fallen into a crisis of goals. Long after both our rockets and our public relations had taken back the lead, the aftershock of that first Sputnik would linger to nag at our self-confidence. But as events played out, reclaiming our confidence would prove far more constructive than taking comfort in it. Perhaps that's why, in the end, we would be the ones on the moon. For NPR News, this is Walter Cronkite.
Our story was produced by John McDonough. You'll find more of Walter Cronkite's essays for NPR on our website, npr.org.